Welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. And you know, we've made a pledge here at Advanced Living Radio to bring value to you week in and week out. And I inspire myself by daily praying, Heavenly Father, show me the best ways to have the most fun inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely, healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Yes, that's a mighty goal, I know, and step by step, week in, week out, a little here, a little there, we will get the job done. Have faith. Keep on. And I want to pause and thank the sponsor of our program, AdvancedLiving.com, the home of the comfort technology. When you want to have instantly less stress, sleep a little better, and do better at your desk around electronics, visit AdvancedLiving.com and check out that comfort technology. You'll be amazed at what that little Clark Kent clock with superpowers can do for you. And guess what? Are we in for a treat? We're getting our year launched, and you know, the year hasn't started off well for everyone in every way. We get the New Year's resolutions. We have some of them we don't hold to. We get disappointed. Stuff, as you know, despite being a new year, sometimes things aren't working out, or for some of us, there's been some tragic losses. And what are we going to do about that? Well, today's the day. We have Dr. Greg Corbon, who is wonderful at helping us because of his own personal life experience. And from that, he wrote the book Beyond Reason, Lessons from the Loss of a Gifted Child. Now, Dr. Corbon, he is an anesthesiologist and graduate of Duke University School of Medicine and an assistant professor of anesthesiology at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina, where he's involved in research and teaching in the neuroanesthesiology, regional anesthesia, and pain management. And he was also assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Virginia Medical Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dr. Corbon has a long-standing interest in outdoor education and is a senior facilitator at the University of Virginia's Poplar Ridge Challenge course. So talk about indoor and outdoor, because as an undergraduate at Duke, he created a week-long adventure course for incoming freshmen now called Project Wild. And, of course, we know freshmen at universities are wild, but his was different. It stood for Wilderness Initiative Learning at Duke, and it became a model for many university outdoor programs. He also, as an active individual, holds a black belt in Taekwondo and a brown belt in Judo, and has logged in over 40,000 miles as a bicycle commuter. He's currently the director of an outpatient surgery center in Central Virginia, where he lives in the Blue Ridge Mountains with his wife, Catherine, and two children. And he has authored a number of books and research articles and developed new techniques that are widely used in his field. Well, we're going to welcome him in and learn more about this Beyond Reason and the lessons of the loss of a gifted child. Hello, Dr. Carbon.
Hello, Ken. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We are so delighted because of the beautiful book you've written and your extensive experience. Now, to just get right into this, I understand your 9-year-old son, Brian, died while playing Little League Baseball. And when did he first tell you, or you had an indication he was going to die?
It was, he died in the spring, the day before Mother's Day. And he told us about 6 months before that. It was time for his 9th birthday party. And Brian said, as the time got closer to his party, we started talking about planning for it. And he said he didn't want to have a party. And he said it would bring his death closer. And he said he would never live till he would never make it to double digits, is what he said, which meant he would never live till age 10. And you know, there was no reason for us to for that to be an issue, and we didn't understand it at all. So we tried to reassure him that he was healthy and everything should be fine, but he started getting very, very depressed. And he had trouble going to sleep at night, and he was talking about death all the time, and we didn't know what to do. My wife's a minister and pastoral counselor, and so we, you know, just did not understand what the issue was here. We took him to a psychologist after a while, because he started becoming increasingly despondent, and he enjoyed the sessions, but... And they got to be great friends, but we never came up with any issues to deal with. But he liked the attention, and he liked, he spent the time. He was a very gifted child and full of life and wonderful sense of humor. He was always playing tricks on people and doing things like that. He loved the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, and he was very much like Calvin. And he would do things like he'd get ideas about things to do. From the comic strip, like we'd have a babysitter and he'd lock her in the bathroom because that's what Calvin did. Things like that. And he had a parents' ball. Calvin had a parents' ball. And so did Brian. So whenever, you know, he was mad at us or something like that, he'd bring out the parents' ball and we'd be down. So, you know, sometimes we'd do something good and we'd be up. But we were usually in the middle of somewhere.
Oh.
So, uh-huh.
Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, I've got it. You know, there's so many stories. I put a few in the book. But he had stage presence, and he got up in front of a crowd. He was the week of his birthday. Instead of celebrating his birthday party, it was kind of like a somber week because he was talking about death all the time instead of celebrating his birthday. But one thing that happened that week was that he was on national TV. There was a TV show called America's Funniest People, and they came to audition here in our town, and Brian insisted that we take him, so we took him there, and the place was crowded, and he told a joke for the camera, and the camera crew started laughing, and they made him retape it 6 times. The joke was, what do you call a tyrannosaurus that's really scared? A nervous rex.
So, That's great.
So it turns out that they said they'd call us if he was going to be on TV, but they never did. So he was watching himself. He was watching Sunday morning cartoons, Saturday morning cartoons. And there he was on national TV. They put his joke on it was a spinoff called America's Funniest Kids. So so he was a showman. He did a lot of things like that. He was a lot of fun to be around. So,
wow. Yeah, That's great. Now, when he, you know, I mean, you said he passed, and I'm just wondering, was there any medical reason to suspect that he was going to die?
No. No, he had heart surgery when he was a baby, but that had been successful, and as far as we knew, he was healthy. We were told he was normal, and he felt normal. He didn't have any problems. And then after he died, the autopsy was normal, and it showed that he must have died of an arrhythmia, you know, an abnormal heart rhythm. And the incidence of that for somebody who had the kind of surgery he did was the same as a normal kid. So it was, you know, it was not expected by anybody except him, of course. He knew what was going on.
Huh.
And it became more obvious as the time came closer. A couple weeks before he died, he started coming out of his depression and becoming very joyful. And he said it was time for his party, but he didn't want it to be a birthday party, just a happy spring party with no presents. And so we set up the party, and then he started talking. He started doing things, and we didn't really realize until after he died all the things that he was doing in this period. But he was finishing up all of his unfinished business, and he wrote letters to his grandparents, which he'd always been meaning to do and never did. He got Catherine's Mother's Day present a week in advance, which he'd never done before. And then he even more unusual, he insisted that Catherine get my Father's Day present, even though that was months away. And a little statue that said "World's Greatest Dad," which of course I treasure very much now. And then he started talking about taking a trip. You know, one day it would be to Wisconsin, another day to Montana, but the issue of the trip came up. And then 2 days before he died, Catherine came home driving down our driveway, and there was Brian pulling his little wagon with his teddy bears and camping gear. And Catherine got out of the car and said, "What you doing?" And he said, "Well, it's time for me to go on my trip." And she said, "We can't go on your trip. You got your party coming, and besides that, I'll miss you if you go away." And he said, "No, I have to go. I can't be a wimp. I have to do it." So she got out of the car, and they sat on the ground and talked about what they could do. And they came up with the idea that instead of going on his trip, he could stay for a couple more days. And then we just pitched the tent out in the yard, and he could spend the night, the next night, night before he died. He could spend that camping out by himself. He'd always been afraid to do that before. So he thought that was a good idea. So the day before he died, we pitched the tent, and he slept out there with our dog, Sasha. Came in, he was so proud of himself for spending the night alone. He was really joyful. The kids came for the party. It was the most beautiful spring day you ever saw. And then his little girlfriend gave him a kiss, and his best friend wrote a song for him. Friends forever, always together. And then the kids left, and he went down to his room to finish up a few things, and then I took him to his baseball field. No, he had always been the smallest kid on the team, and he really was afraid of the hard ball. And I had encouraged him to play baseball because I thought it would be fun. He was a very cerebral kid, really gifted, real smart, but he wasn't very physical, so I thought that would be a good thing for him. But he'd always been afraid of the ball. But on the way to the baseball field, Brian was telling me this was his second game. And the first game, he never scored a run. He got stranded on third base. So as we were going to the baseball field, Brian was telling me that he wanted to score a run more than anything. So we got the baseball field, and he was the happiest little boy he ever saw. And he was charging after the ground balls and begging the coach to make him the pitcher. He was most enthusiastic.
Yeah.
He was having the best time. It was like a total change.
Yeah.
And then he got up to base to bat and got walked to first base because he was so little. And then the next kid hit a triple, and Brian ran around the bases, crossed home, and he was the happiest kid. We were standing up cheering for him. He was getting high fives, give me a thumbs up, and went into the dugout, and then he died. His heart just stopped beating. And then the coach brought him out, and I resuscitated him. And I looked at him, and I thought, you know, he must have had an arrhythmia. I should be able to get him back, because you know, that's what I do. I'm an anesthesiologist. That's what an anesthetic is, basically. You give somebody what's the equivalent to a lethal injection, you resuscitate them. So, and the rescue squad was right across the street, so I knew that they could be there within a couple minutes. But I looked at his little blue face, and I could just tell, I just knew something told me that he wasn't coming back, that he'd finished his work here, and that And that's what happened. So,
wow.
And so after he died, the day he died, there was all of these strange things, that paranormal things that happened. That I'd been taught all my life that there was no such thing as paranormal experience. All the studies had shown that nothing like that really existed, and which is absolutely not true. I have since found, and so I wasn't prepared for any of this stuff. This was totally out of my belief system. But all these things kept happening. So, yeah, if you'd like, I can continue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because, this is quite fascinating to, for especially you, because I think most of us, we may have heard about some of these things, but I don't think all of us have experiences with it, and so skepticism still in that area is fairly rampant.
Well, it is, and that's something that is very important part of the whole story. Was there was the Brian part, which there's so many more wonderful parts to it I'd like to get into, but what I, after I got over the shock, and it took me about a year before I could go to a support group for parents that have lost children called the Compassionate Friends. And it took me another year after that before I could tell Brian's story. And I told Brian's story, about a 10-minute version of it. And then I was quiet. And then the other parents started chiming in with their stories. And it turns out that what we would call, and we haven't talked about too much of the paranormal stuff that happened afterwards, but about half of the kids that were still living with their parents had done something to say goodbye or to draw a picture of how they died. All the parents had some warm, fuzzy experience or dreams or things like that, but there was real hard evidence that the kid knew they were going to die, even if it was an accident. And about half the kids, one 12-year-old boy who died in a car accident, sat down with his mom the night before and had a list of all of his life accomplishments and what he wanted to do in the future. And there was another little girl, and she died in daycare, went down a slide, and a ribbon caught around her neck, and she strangled. And she sounded a lot like Brian. She was a really gifted kid, very joyful. And a half an hour before she died on the playground, she drew a picture of herself in dark colors hanging by the neck. And then over to the side is a picture of her in bright colors putting on yellow halo with an angel up in the sky dropping more halos down to her.
Oh, wow.
And her mom said, she always was full of life, and she always said every day, you know what, I love you with a mad passion. This is a 4-year-old. And she always said, though, she never wanted to grow up and go to school like the other kids. I became aware that what we call paranormal in this setting is actually normal. And whenever I give a talk, especially if I give it to parents that have lost kids, once again, I did that again a year later, and the same thing happened. About half the parents had real evidence that their kid knew that they were going to die.
Hmm.
And then,
just a quick interjection here, Dr. Carbone, because when I'm hearing this, from you, I don't know if there is such a thing, but you might be uniquely positioned, because to help gather these stories.
Well, that's one thing that I did with this with my website.
Okay.
The first thing I wanted to do was tell the story. And it was the most wonderful story, and all these things that happened. So let me just go back to the day he died.
Yes.
I went to the baseball field to get my car, and I went outside the car that my friend drove me there, and it was the most beautiful spring day, and the air was full of honeysuckle, and it was the most joyful place, and there were picnics going on, another little league game going on. And I went to wipe a tear from my eye, and the sweet smell of the honeysuckle and the barbecue in the air combined with the smell of Brian's vomit on my hands from the resuscitation. And then all of a sudden everything got perfectly still, and the colors got brighter and the smells got stronger. than I'd ever experienced. Everything was so much more vivid than I'd ever seen before. And I knew I was at the center of life. And I felt this peace, and I knew that everything was okay, that Brian had done, had finished his work, and that his job was done. If I could bring him back, it would just be for me, not for him. He was finished, and that the rest of the work was mine. So I had kind of that was the first experience I had that day. And we got home, and the first thing we saw was that Brian had left out his parents' balls for us. And for the first time, he'd given us his highest score, a perfect 2,000. You know, it was like right there for us to see. And then he'd also put a note on his door that I didn't realize, but Catherine saw it the first day. And it said, Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me. So he always had some note on his sign, you know, like Brian's Brian's room, keep out, something like that.
But yeah.
This was different. And I just looked at that sign and I said, he knew, you know, he really knew. And how did he know? And there was so much I didn't understand. So there were other things that happened, coincidences and things like that. Later that night, I went down to tuck my daughter in bed, and my daughter has special needs. She's got some cerebral palsy and some learning disabilities, and she couldn't understand that Brian wouldn't be coming back because she was like 7 at that point and developmentally younger than that. Now, I was not a religious person, and I wasn't used to talking about hereafter. I was really an agnostic. My wife's a minister, so I went with her, and we did all that. And I liked the church community, but I had really no experience with organized religion. And so talking about these things was difficult for me. But I told my daughter, Lynn, I said, Brian's gone on to heaven, and he won't be coming home anymore. Well, she thought that was very sad. And she said, he'd take airplane? And I said, no, when you die, you go to... Your body leaves, you know, your soul leaves its body, leaves the body just like a butterfly leaves the cocoon, and then it can fly without an airplane. And then she said, oh, you know, that's sad. I said, it's dark. And then she looked up at the ceiling, and then she got this blissful look on her face, and she was focusing. She obviously could see something that I couldn't see. And but it was just one of those things. She just knew that she was looking at something very real. And then she looked up at through the ceiling and said, oh, Brian, see light. And then I felt a vibration. We were lying on the bed, and I felt the bed vibrating. And then all of a sudden, I could see that we were being carried along by these rippling river of energy waves that I'd never seen before, but I instinctively knew that they'd always been there. I just never could not see them before. And I knew that Brian was still part of it, part of this energy, whatever it was. And so that was kind of like the beginning of my journey to try and understand what had happened, as well as my spiritual awakening. Because, you know, all these coincidences over the next few years opened up. And then the river showed up again towards the end in Brian's last words to me. In the book. It's like the last page of the book. So that's the Brian story part of it.
Mm. Oh, my gosh. So, folks, for more information, of course, about the book, there's a website, beyondreason.info, where you can get more details about that. Is that correct?
Right.
Now, go ahead.
One of the reasons I ended up writing this book, the backstory to the book, is I've gotten a lot of compliments on it, and it's won quite a few awards. It won first prize in the London Book Festival. It's got 5 stars on Amazon. Everybody has read it. It's been very complimentary. And they say it's very well written. Now, the backstory here is that nobody ever had less ability or interest in writing than I did. When I was in high school, if I had to write a poem, I couldn't do it. My parents had to help me. Anything I could do technical in your head stuff, but nothing, you know, that involved emotion, I couldn't write anything beautiful. And so when Brian died, it was such a wonderful story. We had a lot of media people that called because it made the wire services that White House playing Little League. And it got carried all around the country. But nobody would tell the story. I mean, other than he died playing Little League, I would tell them that he
told. Yeah, and after scoring his first home run.
Right, I know.
And I mean, there's more drama. He knew how to script this stuff.
Oh, he did. I mean, the kid was a showman.
Yeah.
And he did it publicly. And maybe there were 50 people before. I mean, we had the school counselors involved with, you know, with the fact that he was saying he was going to die, and his teachers and his friends and all the people at church. So, I mean, there were like 50 people that knew this, and there were another maybe 50, 100 that saw the sign after he died and knew the story. So, I mean, this was a very well-documented event that showed that a kid knew the future. And he was a wonderful kid, too, so he did that so we could learn. And I would think that I thought people would want to know this. So I would tell the reporters, but nobody, their voice would trail off. They wouldn't ask follow-up questions. And nobody would tell the really interesting part of the story, except for one national radio program, very well-known radio personality. But he didn't tell the true story. He changed it. And he made the story that Brian, knowing he was dying of terminal heart disease, wanted to score a run as his last act, and got off his deathbed and made it to the baseball field, got walking or something, and huffed and puffed around the bases, and then collapsed across home plate and died. And I thought, and I heard that, and I thought, why would they want to change the story? It's such a wonderful story as it is. Why would they want to lie?
Yeah.
So it came to me to realize that nobody was going to tell the story. I was going to have to do it. And in order to do that, I was going to have to learn how to be a writer. And so with a great deal of struggle, it took me 15 years to be able to write the story the way it needed to be written. It was, for many years, it was still a tragedy, which is an unfinished story. A tragedy is where the pieces don't come together in a new way where when you're done, you're better. You know, I mean, it's a sad thing that happened, but we're better for it. And so we learn more, and we're more intelligent, we're more compassionate. And so for many years, I was writing to the best of my ability, but the book was a tragedy, was stuck. It never did finish to the point where somebody could read it and move on and feel better for it. And so I did that. And then it finally came together, and it was such a relief. And I had a lot of help along the way, a lot of just amazing teachers and coincidences. And then I created the website for that. Well, and the main reason I did that, besides sharing Brian's story, was that I wanted people to have a place where they could share their stories. So if somebody said, you know, my wife died and she came to visit me after she died, or her favorite food showed up on my doorstep or something like that. I mean, there's so many stories like that. And I wanted a place where people could say, well, you can go to beyondreason.info, because a lot of other people have shared those stories. The same situation that happens when I tell Brian's story and everybody chimes in, and there's a community, and it's very healing. People realize, oh, really? You know, he was really trying to help me. Their child was really trying to prepare me, and I didn't understand. And
yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think what we have on our hands here, I'm getting another message, is that this could be one of the most wonderful TV shows ever done.
A lot of people have said that, that it should be a movie.
Because you want something that can be there on a regular basis, not just a one-time, like a movie.
Movie
would be
show.
Fine, too. I'm just,
just
looking.
With these kind of stories.
Yeah, to some kind of venue there, because there's enough whatever you would call it, juice to it, that people would want to tune in, because it's like, well, what are we going to see next week? And you're already collecting all kinds of things for the scripting of the shows.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to do this work yourself. These stories are out there.
And yeah,
people...
well, I mean, the beauty is, and maybe this is part of Brian's gift, is that he put it into your hands, and then you've created this book, and that you have amazing credibility. I mean, skilled physician with a long career, strong as a man, Taekwondo, you know, martial arts. I mean, there's all this stuff that stands you in a very unique position, and then to be the guide as you put out the Wild Project for taking people into the wilderness. Well, now this is another, to me, kind of wild, where you could be taking people into another wilderness, as they say in Star Trek, going beyond, except we don't have to leave the planet to get there.
Right. Well, people seem to be very hungry.
Huh?
People seem to be very hungry for this sort of information.
Well, yeah.
The way we're raising our children now and the way we've been raised is this part of ourselves has been denied very strongly. I mean, the fact is that the media wouldn't tell the story when he died, no matter how many people would want to hear it. There was a real taboo against that. Now, one of the very encouraging things is that in the 17 years since he's died, there's an alternative media. And, you know, alternative radio, alternative internet. And now there's a way for this story to get out there. So it seems to me that it's part of you that people are finally beginning to wake up. And
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And as I shared with a guest recently, to me, where this is so key and so very important to our lives, is that the mode of us being educated as human beings through the whoever it was, the medicine man or the religious leaders of the major religions on the planet for however many thousands of years, there was nothing in those religions that told about a continuity of life. It's like you're here when you're dead, you're off in heaven or hell, and you're gone, and it wasn't like there being this thing of you're an ever-living soul, and you're in this physical form, but when you go, your existence still continues. That has not ever been part of any major religion that I know of.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Eastern religions talk about that with reincarnation, but in the West, you're right. That's very, very little of that. And this is, you know, what they teach is, even the religions, this is it. You know, this is all there is. As far as your physical existence. But,
Wow, so here's this wonderful, wonderful thing. And, I mean, it's just like, well, thank you, Brian, for being this gift to your father. I was thinking, it's so interesting because as a physician, our body is interesting. If we have a little cut, you see, okay, there's blood and the skin is separated. You see this with in incisions or just little cuts. And then the body knows how to heal itself and to the point where that cut is totally gone and there's no sign that it was ever there. And to me, that's, in a physical reality, kind of one metaphor for us in our physical reality. We may be torn from our physical reality, but our perpetual living spirit never dies.
Well, there's another analogy to that, and that's that your body, your bones are the turnover the slowest. So that's every 7 years, you're a totally new person. And your skin, that turns over like in a week or two. So all of the parts of your body have been totally changed, but you can't tell it. I mean, you look like the same person, but you're a completely new person every 7 years, and you're 90% new every month. But
wow.
there's a continuity to the control system so that all these parts are changed, you know, while you're functioning and you don't realize it, but all the molecules are new.
Hmm.
So that's, you know, there's a lot of things.
Yeah, this is exciting
to think that we're renewed that way. Yeah, there's all kinds of things that touch on this, the kind of fractal, you know, ways of looking at things, where at different levels it's the same thing happening, the same pattern. But one thing that I discovered was that the beautiful things in the book came out of the emptiness, out of the void. And I spent a lot of my time grieving and experiencing the void. And I learned a lot about it and about my spiritual nature, because that's where it is. Everything that you don't know, it's in the void. And the void is most of you. Most of your body is empty space. And what science teaches us is that there's nothing in empty space, but that's not true. The science tells us that empty space has infinite energy. It just isn't in form. It becomes limited when it comes into form. But, and mystics, of course, have always told us that empty space, the void, has infinite intelligence, which has been my experience. So if you just taught science to kids the way it should be taught, then it opens up the possibilities for when people feel this emptiness. We've been taught to be afraid of it. But what you see when you grieve is it's the most creative place that there is. If you allow it to... if you don't try and cover it up, and if you don't try and control it, and you don't try and deny it, it is the source of everything. Like, you know, whatever comes out of it will be, you know, unpredictable. It's more intelligent than you are. So the whole idea of what grief is became very apparent to me, and I had realized when Brian died, after I got over the shock, that I had always been grieving. I just never had a reason. I'd always felt this tremendous emptiness. And that's one reason I did all these adrenaline sports. I mean, I did everything. I jumped out of airplanes. I flew airplanes, did aerobatics, scuba diving. Almost died many times. As a matter of fact, a couple times, it's really miraculous that I survived. Obviously, because I'm supposed to be here talking to you.
Yeah.
But it had always been that I'd been running away from the emptiness that I'd always felt. And that after Brian died, that's where he was. And so I couldn't really run away from it anymore. I just had to go into it and explore it. And he was such a gifted person and so spiritually and intellectually more advanced than I was, that I trusted him, and he obviously had set me up that for this awakening. But more than that, he kept his presence continued, and it was like he left a trail of breadcrumbs for me to follow through the emptiness, and I could trust it. I could feel his presence, and of course, he showed up in dreams and things like that. And then all of these, as I opened up to this tremendous emptiness, the void that he left, then all of these synchronicities came out of it. Things that took me to the Monroe Institute that happened to show up right in my backyard, probably one of the best places in the world for me to learn about the afterlife and non-physical reality. And then I also got to meet Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote the book Magical Child. And if there's anybody on the planet that could help explain a magical child like Brian, it was Joe Pierce, and it turns out that he was right in my backyard too, and I got to meet him.
Oh, wow.
And he got to be my mentor for a couple of years, and he would tell me about all of his experiences around the world and his experiences, just some of the most wonderful experiences. You could not ask for a better teacher, and he's brilliant, and he talks to scientists all around the world, gives lectures. And spirituality, child development, neurological development. And as a scientist, I found, it all started coming together for me. And one of his themes is that children are our teachers. We need to listen to them. They will take us beyond our limited understanding. And so that's one thing I hope people learn from the book.
And part of the book, are people going to be able to help get a little support for some grieving that they may be doing?
Yes, I think that the book can be of great help to people, because you can read through it. It's like a grief. You can follow my grief, and all our griefs are very similar. And you can see all of the different things that can happen to help you along your path, and you can see where it goes. And I also explain. Since it was 15 years, I meditated on grief. What is grief? And I found that the things that I was reading, of course, as a scientist, I went to the literature. I read everything about paranormal stuff because, these things should be impossible. All of these things that happened to me should be impossible according to everything I've been taught, but they had obviously happened. And I became aware that I wasn't going through stages of grief. And I talked to other people, and they weren't either. And yet the things that I read, like the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross information, you talk about stages of grief. And now Elizabeth I got to know her a little bit before she died. So she had a lot of contact with Bob Monroe at the Monroe Institute in her later years. And she was a giant, and she made tremendous contributions. But her work was limited. And I got to appreciate some of that and how we can learn to go beyond some of the things that she had taught and incorporated. And so basically what I learned was, and with my experience taking kids through challenge courses, where you climb rocks and solve problems as a group, give them a 12-foot wall and tell them they have to get over the wall, and go through a maze or something like that. And the key, I also did a little work in the theater, too. And in the theater, when you're a director, the one thing you have to be aware of for every moment is whatever character, whatever the character is doing, it's because they're missing something. Every action on the stage occurs because the character is missing something and trying to find it. So you always ask the actor, if the actor gets stuck, you say, what does your character want at this moment? And then, the actor will think about it. And you say, okay, now what's the clearest action to show that? And that was a big breakthrough in the stage, in theater, with the method by Stanislavski. And then I discovered that the same thing happens when you give a group a task, a challenge. Every challenge begins with the group, the story that the group is missing something. You're on a volcanic island and it's erupting and you need to be rescued. So you need to get a helicopter to get you off. This is what you need to do that. Emptiness is what makes our life go around. The fact that we're missing something. And when it's something small, we are not aware of it as grief. And when it's huge and we're in it, it is our entire life when your child dies. Then we call it grief, but it's the same thing. It's the most creative thing that we do, is deal with our emptiness. And so when you realize that, it's just sort of a matter of scale. And then when you're stuck and you run out of resources, it is actually the emptiness itself that is where you turn. And the emptiness itself, if you trust it, and especially for me, it was easy because I love Brian with all my heart. I can't tell you how much I love that child. And when he's gone, the emptiness, I could trust it now because he was there. And then all of these synchronicities and things would just show up that would help me finish my book and help me find my way. So the whole idea of grief as a just a huge version of what we do every day, but it's the same mechanism. And then the roles of dealing with when we're really stuck, then that's where the Kubler-Ross stages of grief are, because she was a psychiatrist. And if you had a woman who had a stillborn baby, and which happens not uncommon, and refuses to accept the fact that the baby's dead, she'll carry it around. And it's very upsetting to the nurses. And after a couple of days, they would call a psychiatrist. So she would see people like that, and that was denial. Or if you had somebody with a diagnosis of cancer, and they would argue that it wasn't cancer, and they would make it difficult for the treatment to go forward, then the medical people would call a psychiatrist for that, and that would be like anger or bargaining or rationalizing. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did a wonderful job of describing the extremes of the way we cope with any challenge. But she only talks about the extremes, and she leaves out one important part, which is anxiety and depression, anxiety and panic. Because what I realized was that the best way to understand what happens when you have a challenge that is too much for you is the story of the Wizard of Oz. And the characters, when Dorothy is stuck and she really doesn't know what to do, she either loses her dog, which is her most loved, loved connection, or she loses her family. And she's really stuck in that dilemma, and then she goes to Oz. So all of these different characters are all the different coping styles that we have. And it's, we use our brains. As you can see the same thing at a football game. You divide up, when you have a big task, you divide up into these different roles. You have the coaches, they're the brains. And then you've got the cheerleaders, the dancers, and the band, and they provide the spirit, and that's the heart. And then you've got the warriors that deal with the external conflict, those are the football players. And that would be like the witch. And then you have the people that deal with the team's internal problems, and that would be the managers and the trainers and all of that sort of stuff. And that would be the internal conflict, and that would be the cowardly lion. He was always saying, "Well, let's save Dorothy, but talk me out of it." and so you had that's the way people divide up. And then I noticed when I would give a group a challenge, and if you make it too easy for them, then they get bored. And if you make it too hard, they get frustrated, and they start dividing up into these extreme behaviors. Somebody will get angry, and somebody will get depressed, and somebody will get anxious, and it'll be the Kubler-Ross sort of thing, with the addition of the anxiety, which is the scarecrow. She never talks about the scarecrow. She left him out as far as extreme behavior.
Yes.
But though, what you want to do most of the time, it's good to stress the group occasionally so they can see when it's too much for them and they can call it. When they start going to extreme behavior, they can say, "Well, wait a minute, this is too much for us. We're starting to fall apart." But what you want to do, the ideal challenge is one that forces the group to split up and specialize, but not go too extreme. So you give a group something, so somebody has to start taking charge. They're the coach, and somebody has to provide the spirit. Come on, we can do it. And somebody will say, "Okay, I'll get the water, or I'll do this, or And the group will split up, and it'll be the same roles as the Wizard of Oz. And then when they've accomplished their task, they'll come back together again, and they're more capable than they were before. So,
and you go into all this in your book, don't you?
I do,
yeah.
Very briefly, but it's simple. Actually,
yeah.
When you understand how it works, you can describe it in a few pages. So what that does is, now, if I had read my book, it would have been a big help, because I realized, I don't have to go through stages of grief. I take on this role. This is, I'm a Tin Man. I generally get cerebral. That's how I deal with things. And then also I would be the witch. That would be my two. I'd get angry. That would be the two. And then, of course, you're missing the opposite. So you always go looking for your opposite to try and become whole again. But if I would have read that, I would have said, oh, yeah, that's what's going on. It's okay for me not to go through stages of grief. I'm not supposed to get angry. No. I don't have to get angry. I don't have to get depressed.
Yeah, or in that particular order.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, there's no order to that. It's just that, you know, you specialize, and then that's the best way to deal things, to deal with things. You do the role that you're most comfortable with, and then when that runs out and doesn't do any more, then you can try another role. And eventually the roles will come together. You know, when you've healed, you'll have both, you know, both the extremes will come back together.
Wow. That is just excellent. To me, timing is just so beautiful for this one, so that stories of the children giving us these messages can be brought out there. That will touch our hearts and also help us to connect to, wait, death is not the end of things. It's just the conclusion of one stage of our existence. And that's so important to help free people up from the control that I believe has been put forth on the planet for thousands of years. And then beyond that, you're not just giving some good advice, you're there able to help coach people through some of this ability to go into this void and not have it scare the heck out of them.
Right. Yeah, once you become afraid, you lose all of your higher functioning. These things don't open up to you like they do, you know, when you're not afraid. And the nice thing about me was that I had this experience, and I had Brian, you know, that obviously was letting me know that it was okay, and that I could go through this process without being afraid. And he had lost his fear; he had conquered his fear of death at the end, and I could do that too. I mean, he was my teacher; he was an example. That's how, you know, the three ways you learn is example, example, example.
three different ways.
Yeah, and that, you know, and that's what Brian did for me. I mean, he showed me you didn't have to be afraid to play hardball, which, you know, is true, and you don't have to be afraid of death. And then when that happens, all these higher functioning synchronicities, things like that, can all take place. And then also, though, what he taught me was that you can learn from the children. So I talk about it a little bit in the book, but and with Joe Pierce. But now, if I get stuck, and if there's a young child around, if I get stuck with something, I'll ask the child what to do. I have a couple examples. When we had another son, Matthew, and when he was four, I was taking an IQ test I found in a magazine, and there was one question that I couldn't figure out the answer, even after looking at the question. Even after looking at the correct answer. And it was a very complicated geometrical progression of shapes and colors. And so he walked by, and I said, Matthew, what's the answer to this question? And he glanced over and said, B, the correct answer. I said, how'd you know that? And he said, I don't know. And then I think it was maybe later the day, I was filling out an application for preschool for him, and I told him I needed to write his weight down. So I said, go in the bathroom and jump on the scale and weigh yourself. Tell me how much it is. So he came back, and he said a 3 and a 0, because he didn't know how to count 30 yet. And then a couple hours later in the evening, I was filling out an insurance physical application, and I wrote down my weight as 180. And so Matthew said, oh, 6 Matthews. So, and it was a couple years before he knew division and multiplication. But I've become aware of the fact that when children are very young, especially, they're very much tied into intelligences that are greater than ours, and that you can use them as a resource.
Wow, Oh, this is exquisite, especially because we're dealing with a major crisis in the schools.
Oh, the schools! I'll tell you.
We could go on for another hour, and we've got about a minute to wrap up for today. My gosh, the time flies when you're having fun.
Right. Yeah. Oh, there's tons of stuff about kids in schools.
Yes. Well, definitely, we'll have to have you back on as a guest another time.
Dr.
Carbon, this is exquisite, and I just want to thank you so much for taking time and tell people, please, this is an exquisite book, Beyond Reason, and you can get it at beyondreason.info as one of the resources for it. And there's just so much more than meets the eye, and of course, go visit his website to see other resources that are there. Wow, this is great. I'm just honored, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule for us.
Oh, well, thanks for any time I get to share Brian's story, it's a real gift for me. So thanks for letting me do that.
Oh, you're welcome, and just wish you so much, and thank Brian, for I know he's looking in and smiling at us and saying, hey, I think you guys got some good ideas, carry on, and so we'll do that. And just thank you, and to my beloved listeners, tune in every week as we'll be bringing you more fun and adventure for better living here at Advanced Living Radio. And until we meet again, God bless, and goodbye for now. Let go of it.